Good afternoon. I'm Martha Anderson. I am the director of the, National Digital Information Infrastructure and Preservation Program at the Library of Congress. Often we're referred to as NDIP. When we want to shorten it, we just say the National Preservation Digital Preservation Program. So this afternoon, I'm going to share a little bit with you about an overview of the work that's been going on in the United States, and kind of an analysis of where I think we as a larger community are at this point in our infrastructure work. There's an African proverb that says, when spiders unite, they can take down a lion. This picture was taken in August of 2007 by an employee of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. The ranger discovered this web that stretched over 100 yards, just under about 100 meters. Immediately, over 1,000 tourists and scientists converged to study and gaze at the web, and it was discovered that the work was the result of many types of spiders. By early September, enough analysis had happened that Science Daily reported that a biologist had identified almost a dozen spider families. Entomologists speculated that the park's spider population exploded due to wet conditions that resulted in abundance of small insects upon which spiders feed. The interesting aspect to me of this whole thing was that the web was the work of hundreds of spiders from 11 different spider families working alongside each other. It resulted in a phenomenal structure, but it was not a single web, but many simultaneously created structures. While the giant spider web story encourages us to expect some parallel work to result in larger results, when we consider infrastructure, we need to balance both the social and technical if we're to realize true infrastructure. The opportunity for the Alliance for Permanent Access and the National Digital Preservation Program and other preservation organizations is to evolve into a truly connected infrastructure, and the conditions are right. For those of you who may not be familiar with our program, the National Digital Infrastructure Program was chartered in 2000 by the U.S. Congress with a mission to ensure access over time to a rich body of digital content through the establishment of a national network of partners committed to selecting, collecting, and preserving at-risk digital information. Congress wanted its money's worth out of us, I think. The program set out to seed networks of organizations to address technical and policy issues while learning about the evolving practice of preservation of digital information. Through the program, we have engaged in 70 projects with over 185 organizations across a variety of content, infrastructure, and policy work. We thought of it from the very beginning as a network of people and an architecture for preservation. This kind of shows a map that we did for our report that was published this year of the communities we engaged across the initiatives. And what we saw as we launched each new initiative was that the partners in the initiative would begin to form alliances with partners in the new initiatives across certain lines. I'll give you a few examples. We had universities, we had commercial organizations like the Motion Picture Academy, we had music producers, we had computer scientists, we had state libraries and archives, And across this range, we saw many common interests evolve. So I'll give a couple of examples. The NDIP program and JISC co-sponsored with the National Science Foundation a Blue Ribbon Task Force a few years ago on sustainability of digital preservation and access. In the work that this panel did, we interviewed a broad range of industry representatives, financial, aerospace, scientific, cultural heritage. There were common threads across all of the testimonies about storing and managing digital content over time. When we approached the commercial content community, the movies and the music producers, much to our surprise, we found out that they were just as concerned about metadata as libraries and archives. We've seen photographers associations and music recording artists working to gain consensus in their industry and to build tools for metadata, for photographs and sound recordings. For them, it's important to have the metadata because it's their way of tracking their products and they can leverage it for their own business. But for libraries and archives, the metadata becomes a real gift at time of deposit. Most recently, we had an interesting interaction. We sponsor a digital storage meeting every fall, in which people get together and talk about what are the current technologies being used, what are the current challenges, how have perceptions of the use of storage changed over time, that sort of thing. But we've been able to understand video management and storage better because of the work of the Major League Baseball organization. We thought we knew about video. They record those games, they record 6 copies of it from different angles, and they have metadata management down to a fine science. They have a touch screen entry for people to add metadata and to give various aspects instead of keying this in. So we really need to benefit as libraries from that kind of technology. With the NDIP communities, we've seen crossover from among libraries and content producers, but we've also seen real synergies with computer scientists. Early on, we co-sponsored an initiative with the National Science Foundation, and some of those researchers from that early effort have stayed with the work over the last 10 years, continuing to interact because they found the problems interesting and they've made some true contributions to change. We are currently working with Los Alamos National Labs and Old Dominion University. And their work has some promise for a kind of an invisible infrastructure for navigation and discovery of archived websites. And we're doing a pilot with 39 national libraries that we're currently engaged in that. We're working on 15 terabytes of indexes and moving that around's been fun. But we hope to have an unveiling of the prototype in May. Over the years, we ask our partners from time to time to draw a picture of what they were doing. And so this is just one of them I wanted to share with you. This is from DataPass. They are the social science network that was formed out of the NDIP program. They began with 5 social science data repositories. ICPSR is not a small organization itself, but and they began from the beginning with the idea that they would expand and would continue to be part of an international community. And so they drew this picture and they said, so we have a simple network, and they did. They had simple governance, simple rules for working together. But they saw themselves embedded in a very complex world. And this is just a little map of the way they saw their technologies developing and the infrastructure needs they would have. So, about 2007, I think, the National Science Foundation had a workshop and they published this report, Understanding Infrastructure, Dynamics, Tensions, and Design. And the workshop report defines cyber infrastructure as a set of organizational practices, technical infrastructure, and social norms that collectively provide for the smooth operation of scientific work at a distance. And I would amend that scientific work to include just about any kind of research, cultural heritage, business, whatever. So that's what cyber infrastructure needs to do. The report was targeted at looking at this infrastructure for a lot of reasons. Primarily, the two main goals in the US now are long-term stewardship of digital content and open access for federally funded materials, projects, research, that kind of thing. The report, though, pointed out three tensions in the work. And I think everyone in this room has probably experienced these. One, time. Funding schemes are usually short-term, but it takes a long time to grow an infrastructure. Scale. There are disconnects between global interoperability and local organization. And agency. The navigating the processes between what's planned and engineered and what emerges. The report, I thought, described very well our emergent infrastructure experience with the NDIP program. We've seen the social and the technical aspects of the work shift, but overall, we've followed a similar path of infrastructure growth that the report outlined, and I'm going to read a little bit from the report here. It says the initial stage in infrastructure formation is system building, characterized by the deliberate and successful design of technology-based services. So we've all seen, and we are testimony today, the people in this room, to repositories, local processes and workflows, shared tools. The next phase is the technology transfer. And in that transfer, and we saw this with the DataPass project, the software was developed at Harvard with the whole network kind of kibitzing over the shoulders. But they decided that they would each adapt the original software to their own local needs. So you see that a lot. People like the idea, but they want to do something a little bit different, or as we say at the library, they're special. We have a whole department at the library that we call the Department of Convincing People They're Not Special, but it's that kind of thing. Anyway, so during this second phase where there's tech transfer, there's also a rise of competition. And I do believe the NDIP program provided the conditions for this transfer across the cultural heritage domain, and to some extent encouraged competition as we learned from our experience and we wanted to leverage a lot of our options. The third phase defined in the report was that, and I'll read again from the report, infrastructures typically form only when various systems merge and in a process of consolidation characterized by gateways that allow dissimilar systems to be linked into networks. So the words in this phase are consolidation and networks. In this phase, and I hear this is something we've heard a lot today, standardization and inter-organizational communication techniques are critical. I think this is the current phase we see in the United States right now. And I would say we're in the process of forming infrastructure as we work more intensely across now domains of science and cultural heritage. And then the last phase, which is probably thrown in there as a cautionary tale to all of us who feel very proud of what we have accomplished, is as multiple systems assemble into networks and networks into webs, early choices constrain the options available. Infrastructure is what allows these social affiliations to thrive and produce. So the things we have built and the things we love will also affect what we can do in the future. And I think we've got a lot of very forward-thinking people around the world who are trying to think, how do we sustain the work and how do we encourage it to grow? So Many of you heard of the National Science Foundation DataNet program. It funded two projects a few years ago, and these are large-scale projects. They were trying to address this problem of time and scale and agency, so to speak, by funding large projects over a period of time. But their whole goal was to bring together multi-disciplines across domains. Library science could benefit the scientific community. The scientific community had a lot to teach libraries and archives. So they funded 19 organizations in five major endeavors. Three of them were just announced this summer. And their investment has been about $80 million, or their pledge has been about $80 million to date. Here's an example of the kind of thing they were looking at. One recent awardee stated that their project would enable new modalities of sustainability science, the study of dynamic interactions between nature and society. The projects are addressing ocean observations, human population and environment, atmospheric and space observations, data from studies of anthropology, astronomy, crop and soil sciences, physics, it just goes, biology, engineering, it goes on and on. But what NSF was trying to do was help foster and nurture these new types of organizations that included library and archival sciences, cyber infrastructure, computer and information sciences, and domain science. So this is a picture from Data One, the Data Observation Network for Earth. They see their project as a distributed framework, and you can tell it's hard to see the lines here, but it's quite an interesting picture. But here's their statement about themselves. Data One intends to be domain agnostic, progressively expanding to broader domains and building on infrastructure and interoperability with DataNet partners. A lot of what they're incorporating into their network are pre-existing technologies, things that have already been tried and used by some of the partners. So they're weaving together the experience of the community at this point. I just have one more recent development from the US federal government. Yesterday, the Office of Science and Technology Policy at the White House issued a request for information regarding the support of long-term stewardship and encouragement of open access to unclassified federally funded research data and publications. This is part of a series of work that they have done over the last few years. It will be interesting to watch where this consultation goes and what the White House learns from it for as far as public policy. So this brings me to my last slide. Not sure if you can see it real well. Over the years of working with the NDIP partnerships, we gained some insight about the interactions. And we had a consultation in 2009 with IBM's open source and social media research divisions. And their survey interviewed a lot of the NDIP partners and kind of asked them questions about why they were doing this, what benefit they got out of it, what roles should be, what were the strongest roles. One of the things that the IBM study observed is committed organizations were motivated by their own interest and their own incentives. But as a group, they acted on behalf of the public interest. And I think that's true. We've seen that in other work we've been involved with. If there is no local benefit for the work, even though you may be getting a grant for it, it cannot be sustained. It cannot live beyond the moment of the funding. So it's really important when engaging in these activities to think about what is the benefit to the local. So this balance of local and global is always at play. Another thing they observed is that each participating institution brings to the network its own resources, interest, and organizational culture. But under the auspices of the neutral convener, and they considered the library, actually these partners considered the library a neutral convener, natural networks emerge over time through their shared activities, problem solving, and meetings. And we've seen that as different kinds of sectors come together over a problem. And then the last point that they observed is that as these networks form, the larger network has grown in complexity, but also in strength and the ability to withstand stresses and shocks. And some examples have been over the last few years, our states have seen the economy tank pretty rapidly as far as their state government support and that kind of thing. And some of our PIs have been laid off. And yet, because they were involved in a network, their work was able to be sustained by others who were committed to it. In 2010, the National Digital Stewardship Alliance was chartered as an initiative of the NDIP program. It's a collaborative effort. It's a continuation of our earlier funded partnerships, but it's expanding. It involves government agencies, educational institutions, nonprofits, business organizations. The goal is to preserve a distributed national digital collection for the benefit of citizens now and in the future. And their commitment is to ensuring long-term access to historically, culturally, and/or scientifically significant digital content. They're working together on standards, infrastructure, innovation, outreach, training, pretty much all the categories of things that many of you have mentioned today. For governance, though, we are using this thing called the Constellation Model, and that's what this is a picture of. The Constellation Model of collaborative governance was first used in Canada for a partnership for children's health and the environment. And many of you may be familiar with Mark Sermon from Mozilla. He and his wife kind of developed this concept and wrote about it. And as we studied and looked for governance approaches for this kind of new network that was growing, there was some appeal in this. Factors for organization of a model like this are collaborative leadership, collaboration catalyst, kind of like the Library of Congress, that serves as a third-party secretariat. And that's what that little circle over on the left is. There's a line that goes through it. On one side it says chaos, and on the other it says order, and that's where we think we live a lot. There's a division of content and process, so they don't all different roles are served. There's an incubation and capacity building of new constellations, and those are those big bubbles out there. These are networks within networks. There's facilitated emergence, so it's not completely engineered. As opportunities arise, and at the top of the chart is this box that says magnetic attractors, and that's the space that many of us find ourselves in. The opportunities are vast. Members get out of it what they put into it. So the MOU that is signed for the alliance doesn't ask for money, but it asks for commitment to serve on a working group, commitment to provide labor to the work in a voluntary capacity, but actually it does use the resources of the joining institution. And then that leadership moves from partner to partner. And so there is a coordinating committee with representation from different sectors that is responsible for the strategic vision and leadership. So today we have 100 members from across commercial, federal and state government, nonprofit, professional associations, universities, 7 of those members are consortia and professional organizations, who represent about 800 other organizations. Some of the things that interest the groups right now are consolidation of standards. We know there are a lot of standards in use, and so the group decided they wanted to document those standards, and that's part of this consolidation phase. But they realized that there was a lot of documentation already out there. So they're using Wikipedia to improve the standards articles in Wikipedia and build a portal to the standards. So they're leveraging work that others have done but improving on it. Another interesting piece of work that we'll be publishing later in the year has to do with a storage survey of the members. If you ever wondered what people really do about storage, well, we found out. We had about an 80% response rate, and David, and you guys will be real happy to hear this, over 60% of them intend to pursue certification, so there's probably a market out there they really did. They indicated that they want to receive a professional credential. They collectively, and don't repeat this, collectively the organizations who responded manage over 29 petabytes of data, and most of them, it's kind of interesting, it skews toward the more data you have, the fewer copies you can support. So the average number of multiple copies is about 2.5. So that's something to look into. So I think I want to report that the American landscape, the DataNet, which includes organizations that are part of the NDIP, original NDIP program and are now part of the Stewardship Alliance, I think it's coming together in terms and becoming a network in terms of the National Science Foundation Infrastructure Report definition. And we are trusting that it will enable more global affiliations to take down the tiger of digital preservation. Thank you.
Wow, thank you. Will you take a couple
sure.
of questions?
Sure, sure.
We have a few minutes.
It's done. Oh, there you are. Okay.
I promised you I'd ask you a question. One of the most frustrating things about being a doctor is we don't have access to the latest data and reports. And you see papers that you want to read when you're managing a particular person or a particular condition. How long do you think it's going to be before most of that data is open source and accessible to medical professionals? Or do you think the current publishing companies will maintain their stranglehold on the data?
I shouldn't speculate. I work for an organization that is also the home of the Copyright Office. But I do want to say that there is, I think, more and more awareness of the necessity for open source. There's also, as I pointed out, with this White House consultation that was announced yesterday, more and more of an awareness that the public purse pays for much of this research and publication, actually, and that I think policies especially have already started to change. I mean, the first change in the U.S. was a change toward having a data management plan, but I think the policies are moving more in the direction of open access. Now, that doesn't mean free for all, but National Library of Medicine, I think, has a good handle on how to perhaps create a portal for the medical profession to use the literature.
Other questions?
I'll run away. Anyway, otherwise, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity, David.
Well, thank you for coming.
Okay.
So thank you once again to all of these speakers.